welcome those who braved the cold, and those who are not in Israel, Florida, or other places which are warmer, or who are not, right, those who are not sick. By the time we've eliminated all the other groups, we have we are the ones who are left. Last time, we covered much of Eov's response to Eliphaz, but we still have a ways to go, and then I want to hopefully start on Bildad and his opening speech. Just to quickly cover what we did, his opening section, Eov's opening section in response to Eliphaz. Remember, well, Eliphaz had said suffering happens for a reason, there is a narrative in life, there are happy endings. Man is no match for God in righteousness or in strength. Being outraged is self-defeating. God is benevolent, just, and protecting, so you should pray to him and then things will be better. And his first response was to say that my outrage is not meaningless and for nothing. My outrage is because of the way God has hurt me. That was his opening part of chapter 6. He moved on from that to say that Eliphaz has betrayed him. But he moved through multiple phases in this comment, in his comments about betrayal. First saying, you know, your advice about being patient isn't going to help me. We had this whole piece about time and the slave who's subject to someone else's time and the worker who's anticipating reward for his time. He played with time in a variety of different ways, as we talked about. Then he switched approaches to saying that you are like a stream of water that disappears. I had hoped for your help, and in fact, there is no help. Then he switched approaches, saying, I actually didn't want your help, and I didn't ask for any assistance. And then finally, he said, tell me where I am wrong. And that brought us to the end of chapter 6. Tell me where I am mistaken. Then in chapter 7, he began by saying, my pain and my hopelessness are worse than death. And his point was to respond to Eliphaz. When Eliphaz says things can get better, he says, no, they can't. Things aren't going to get any better. Things are not going to improve if I wait. My suffering is such that it's just going to keep on going. And that was actually where we talked about the slave and the worker and the time element. That was on that piece. But that brings us to Perek Zayin, Pasuk Zayin, chapter 7, sentence 7. If you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh, it's page 1629. And this is the concluding part of Job's response to Eliphaz, in which he turns away from Eliphaz and he talks to God, which is a first within the book, where he's actually going to speak to God directly. But it's also a response to Eliphaz, because Eliphaz said to him, you should talk to God, you should pray, and then things will improve for you. So he says, okay, you want me to talk to God? Fine, I'll talk to God. But what he says is not what Eliphaz wanted him to say. Take a look. We'll start reading from chapter 7, sentence 7. Once again, it's page 1629. He says, Zechor ki ruach chayai, lo sashuv eini lir'oth tov. Remember that my life is ruach. Ruach meaning wind, ruach meaning something temporary, something fleeting, but we have more to see about the word ruach. We're not done with that. Lo sashuv eini lir'oth tov, my eyes will never again see anything good. I have no hope. Lo sishuvi ein ro'i einecha bi ve'eineni. The eye that sees me will not see me. You will turn your eyes to me, and I won't be here anymore. Right? I'm part of this imagery of someone who is fleeting, someone who is here and gone. Kala anan vayelach, the cloud dissipates and it goes away. Kala and vayelach, two different ways in which a cloud might disappear, one by falling apart and the other by going away. Kain yored sheol lo ya'aleh, so too one who descends to the grave will not come up. We're going to come back to that also. There's a lot we have to see here. I just want to finish this section first. Lo yashuv od leveiso, sentence 10, he will never return to his home. Velo yakirenu od mekomo, his place will not recognize him any longer. He won't be there anymore. And then Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11, finishes this mini section with a triple clause sentence. Gam ani lo echsoch pi adabra bitzaruchi asicha bimar nafshi. He says, I will not hold back my mouth. I will speak the pain of my ruach. There's that word again. Asicha bimar nafshi. I will speak the bitterness of my soul. So you expected me to pray to God. What I'm about to do is to turn to God indeed, but in a very different way. I have no hope of things getting better. I have no long-term dreams. There is no long-term for me. I'm like a cloud. I'm like the wind. So what I'm going to do when I turn to God is I am going to speak of my pain. That's what Eov plans to do. Interestingly, if you take a look on your sheet, it's source number one. The Talmud comments here on Job's approach to God. Part of a series of comments on Job. We'll see more of it in a little bit. But look at number one. This is commenting on an earlier statement of Eov, an earlier statement of Job from the beginning of his speech to Eliphaz. He said, if only my rage could be weighed on the scale, right? If only my pain could be carried all together on the scale. So Amar Rav, Afra Lepume de Eov. Rav says, literally, dust upon the mouth of Job. Chavrusa klape shemaya. Is there chavrusa, collegiality towards God? He addresses God like he's on his level, like he's somebody he can just talk to. He's accusing God of injustice, effectively, by demanding that his pain be weighed on the scales. Who are you to talk to God like that? That's their response in the beginning of this section. The beginning of chapter 6. That's nothing compared to what we're about to see now in chapter 7 in terms of the harshness that he is going to express. They're horrified by his directness. However, Job is not going to cross a certain line in this section. He's going to keep a certain boundary. If you take a look at source number 2 from Amos Chacham's Dat Mikra commentary, he says, Ein Eov kofer bekach she'elokim ma'anish es ovrei ritzono. We're not going to see Job deny that God punishes those who, in fact, have violated his will. Elatana sohi she'ein davar zelatovas ha'adam. What we're going to see instead from Job is the claim that when God does this, it's not good for human beings. And it also doesn't bring any honor to God. As Dat Mikra understands what he's going to say, it's Job criticizing, not in the sense of saying there is no justice from God, but saying that God, the way that you manage your universe, isn't wise. It's not wise for people, and it's not wise for you. Ladat Eov, from Eov's point of view, Lu lo haya Elokim samli bo lemaasei ha'adam, lo haya adam sovel kol kach, v'af Elokim haya mechubad yoter. He says, if God would not pay such close attention to what human beings do, so human beings wouldn't suffer so much, and God would have greater honor. And we'll see what that means as the Dat Mikra says this, as it plays out across the rest of the chapter. But the point that I want us to hold in our heads as we read what Eov says is to ask ourselves, what does he say and what does he not say? Even when he turns to God directly here for the first time within the Sefer, he's not going to say everything. But he's still going to hold back. So that's something to keep in mind, despite the Talmud saying, boy, does he have hubris for speaking to God in this way. So what we've seen in this opening section, sentences 7 to 11, he said, I am just breath, I will never see goodness again, I'm here and gone, I'm like the cloud that dissipates, one descends to Sheol and never reappears. That line, Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11, Rebecca.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if people see that as negating some form of Tiyat HaMetzah.
Oh, yeah.
And not just Tiyat, but some sort of afterlife, like, this is it, it's over.
Well,
possibly, or an afterlife.
When he says never returning here, or never coming back here, you could read it legitimately either as saying, that's it, person dies and he's gone, the soul doesn't exist anymore, or you could read it as saying never returning to this world, which would simply negate the traditional Jewish idea of Chiyat HaMeitim, that the dead do come back, which we find in his contemporary of Daniel, right? Daniel is either right before this or at the same time as it. So take a look, in fact, at source number 3, another passage from that same section in the Talmud. On our verse here, Kala Anan Vayelach Ken Yoreh Sheol Lo Ya'aleh, the one who descends to Sheol. Sheol is a term that's used around Tanakh for the grave, the place where one goes after this world. So he won't come back. Amar Rava Mikan Shekafar Iyo B'tchiyas HaMeisim. So Rava says, yeah, he's denying the resurrection of the dead. Yeah.
So what is Rava and Rav saying by critiquing Iyov?
What do you think?
Well, because he's not retroactively getting the punishment. It can't be a retroactive punishment, can it?
You mean punishment before the crime?
Yeah.
No. They're not. I don't think they're viewing it that way. However, they are, I think, viewing it as an insight into his true character.
But you can't get punished for thinking.
Well, I don't know that that's true.
Do we know?
I don't know that that's true. I mean, I know that from a Jewish law perspective, the only type of sin for which there can be any penalty, I'm sorry, the only type of thought for which there can be any penalty is idolatry. There is such a concept as being punished for an idolatrous thought.
These aren't.
Having said that, I don't think they're looking at it as this triggers his punishment as much as this indicates the sort of person that he is. And therefore, when put to the test, maybe that's why God says, okay, I guess I can let the Satan do this to him. Because he is, on some level, unworthy. This is one approach to the Job problem. Right? How could it be that he's suffering this way? Well, look at what he said. Look at him. Look what happens. How he expresses himself.
So he's not saying anything very different than what Abraham said to God that when he was telling him to do justice in the stone, because he's asking God to do justice. He's not doing very much different than what Kohelet said, when Kohelet also said, we go down to the grave and that's it. So,
right. So two different cases there, mentioned.
I would say it's an unclear. Because I think he's also questioning afterlife and anxiety.
Well, the whole section is saying,
right, questioning if there's anything to life other than what we have right here. But Abram, when he says, if I don't have anybody to inherit, then what's good? I mean, anyone who questions their life.
Well, I think that's probably taking Avram too far, no? I mean, saying that all I really want is an heir doesn't mean that there's nothing else. But in terms of this, you know, this particular point, Abraham is much more respectful in the way that he approaches God. He consistently refers to God as his master, and he asks it as a question. He says, would you do this? Chalil alecha, it would be a desecration for you to do this. Whereas Job is very direct in his statements about, as we'll see, we haven't read it yet, but in the rest of this chapter, he's going to speak very directly in his critique of God's ways.
Kohelet,
I think, is a different thing altogether, because I don't believe that Kohelet should be read as a linear book. In other words, from my understanding of Kohelet, it's much more, here's an idea, here's another idea, sort of going round and round. And therefore, I'm not sure you can actually identify a conclusion at any point within the book of, okay, this is what I've decided, as much as he's putting ideas out there for...
So at least one of the voices in Kohelet...
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. And we'll get critiqued in the same way, Talmudically. You know, remember the whole passage in the Talmud where they talk about how the sages wanted to put away Kohelet and not publish it because they were afraid that some of the lines were, as the Talmud sees it, misleading and contradictory to other lines. But in terms of what's going on here, absolutely, what Job is saying is... there's no hope after this, and the Talmud calls him on it and says, maybe that's why he's suffering in this way. Maybe that's what's going. Now, Rabbi Sadja Gaon disagreed and said, not so fast. If you take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Sanjay Gaon, writing in the 10th century, in his work of philosophy, Emunot V'Dayot, which was profiled in a book review in Toronto Torah this past Shabbos, so if there's any copies still floating around your shul, I think there are some here in the Beit Midrash, you could read the book review, which I authored. But if you take a look at source number 4, he writes, V'izbonanti kol zeh heitev. He says, I've examined all of this well. This, meaning the passages that are brought as arguments against belief in the resurrection of the dead. He says, I have not found in any of the statements evidence that the Creator, that God said He is not going to resurrect the dead. I will call this sipur. All of this is simply saying that a person can't return from the grave after he has descended there. He doesn't get to shake off the dust and come home. It doesn't mean there's never any resurrection. What it's saying is, when we bury somebody, they stay there. That's the statement about what happens within our day-to-day lives and what we see in the world. Rav Sadia Gaon is not willing to accept that Job is denying it. Why not? Why is he so insistent on that? So we have to look at his greater theory about Job. But he's not so quick to read it this way. But the overall theme in this section is, I am frail and temporary. I have no hope. And therefore, when you're telling me I should pray to God and things are going to get better, I don't believe you. I don't have time for things to get better. My life isn't that long. And therefore, he turns to God, and this is what he says. Take a look, please, at sentences 12 to 21 now. He turns to God, and he says, Hayam ani im tanin. Am I the sea? Am I a crocodile, an alligator, whatever creature you want to give? The art scroll here renders Tanin as sea giant, and that tends to be the way that this is looked at. That it's not just about being a crocodile or an alligator, but am I some monstrous creature that needs to be guarded? God, why are you paying such close attention to my actions? Let's say, as Dat Mikra said, let's say you are punishing me because I've done something wrong. But really, do you need to pay such close attention to me? And the scholars, when they look at this line, primarily among the secular readers, they look at Yam and suggest Yam doesn't mean the sea, but rather it means some sea god. Like, am I some kind of a sea god or some kind of a leviathan that you need to supervise me? Kitasim alai mishmar, that you need to place a watch on me. Right? What's the big deal if I do something wrong somewhere? Why are you watching me, God? Ki amarti tenachameni arsi, yisa besichi mishkavi. When I think I'm going to get a little bit of privacy and a little bit of respite, I said my bed will comfort me. Right? The place where I lie down, that is what will carry my siach, my speech, the talk of my suffering. When I think I'm just going to sleep, V'chitatani b'chalomot, you frighten me with dreams. U'mechezionot tiva'atani. Notice he's now speaking to God directly, right? From visions, you will terrorize me. V'tivchar machanak nafshi maves me'atz mosai. He says, I would just choose death. And once again, we ask, he doesn't consider suicide at all in this book. But he says, I would have been much happier, machanak, from chanak, lachanok. We would be happier being strangled. He prefers death. We're on chapter 7, we just read sentence 15. He says, ma'asti lo la'olam echyeh. Ma'asti should have an exclamation point. He says, I am revolted by my life. Lo la'olam echyeh. He says, I'm not going to live forever. Chadal mimeni ki hevel yamai. So just leave me alone already. Stop paying attention to me. My life is hevel, right? Borrowing from Kohelet, the term. My life is empty. It's futile. Why are you keeping me alive? Ma enosh ki tegadleno v'chisashis elav libecha. What is man that you should elevate him, and what is man that thou, right? That thou. No. What is man that thou art mindful of him. right? It's on the law library, I think, at Harvard. I'm blanking on the word. The facade. The Ma'enosh kisiz kerenu uven adam kisif kedenu. What is man that thou art mindful of him? This statement that's made in Tehillim is completely turned on its head. Right? Ma'enosh kisiz gadalenu. What is man that you should elevate him? V'chisashis elav libecha. That you should pay attention to him. Why are you paying attention to me, God? Whereas in Tehillim, right, the point of the psalm is to say, God, you are so wonderful. Why do you pay attention to us? It's so great that you do. He says, what in the world are you doing, God? Why are you bothering with me? Hold on, I just want to read through the section and then we'll come back to it. But why are you paying attention to me? Vatifkidenu livakarim. You remember me every morning. Every morning you look at me, God. Right? Lirgaim tivchanenu. From at every moment, you examine humanity. What for? He says in sentence 19, he's getting going here. Kamalos ish emimeni, lo sarpeni ad biliruki. He says, you aren't going to turn away from me. That word, lishot, is an interesting word. Lo tish emimeni. If you remember the story of Cain and Hevel and the carbon they bring, Vayisha Hashem, El Hevel Vel Minchato, Vel Cain Vel Minchato, Lo Sha'a, to turn to an offering. So he says, God, frankly, I'd rather be Cain. I'd rather that you not turn to me. Lo tarpeni ad biliruki. You don't even let me go to the point where I could just, you know, swallow my saliva. About the only person in Tanakh who thinks this way, or who speaks this way, that I can think of is Yonah. Right? When Yonah wants to run away and say, God, you know, look at other people, don't look at me. That's basically the only one I can think of who turns to God with this kind of an approach. He said, Chatasi, Pasuk 20, Pasuk Chaf. If I have sinned, Ma'efalach, what have I done to you? Notzer ha'adam, you who guard man, you're watching man. Lama samtani limifgalach ve'aya alayla masa. He says, why is it that you are watching me? You're setting me up in opposition to you. Why am I a burden to you? Umeh, he closes the chapter and he closes his speech. Umeh lo sisa pish'i, why will you not bear my sin? Visaviris avoni, and why will you not forgive my iniquity? Ki atala afarishkav, I would just lie down in the dust. That's all I want to do. Vishichartani, and you will seek me. A term that we usually use for prayer, l'shacher, he has used earlier in the book to talk about how you pray to God. Now he's turning it around. If you would seek me, ve'eneni, and I simply would cease to exist. Very strong, no? Very strong. But again, as Dat Mikra noted, he's not challenging divine justice. At this stage, he has not said that God has done anything that is unjust. What he's saying is, am I worth your attention, God? And really, you can't give me a break? It's degrading for you to be spending your time, so to speak, whatever that means. But it's degrading for you, God, to be spending your time on little me. What have I really done? What am I worth? I'm here and gone. Yes?
This is the same guy who was so worried his kids would make mistakes between when they went to bed, when he went to bed until they woke up the next morning, and then he made sacrifices the next day just in case. But he always believed that God was watching every little second and every little step.
Yes.
It changed. So
correct.
He was complaining that God was watching every little second and every little step.
No, I think that's precisely the point. I think you're right. He hasn't changed at all. In the beginning of the book, we saw somebody who believed God cares about even the thoughts that his kids are having at the feast, and he's going to bring an offering in case they sinned in their minds. And at this point, having now suffered because, at least it seems, he believes that he fell short in some way, he turns to God and he says, frankly, I don't really understand why you do that. Why did you make me bring all these offerings? Why do you pay attention like this? I think he's entirely consistent with that idea, as you're pointing out. But where his reaction first was, okay, I'm going to toe the line, his reaction now is to complain about the line. Like, what is this? Why are you doing this to me? I think he's actually entirely consistent, if greatly frustrated. It's really, it's a remarkable speech for somebody who has just experienced this trauma. He's able to articulate very well what's on his mind. Although, as we pointed out last week, we continue to see here, he's turning words on their head. Sorry?
Yeah, well, we can think about it.
Yes. True. So for a week, all this has been going around and around in his head. We don't even know if he had a pencil. He's sitting there scribbling and correcting. But what he's doing here is really dramatic. And it's an expression of, clearly an expression of his pain and his frustration. It's also poetic. Like, if you take a look in the beginning of chapter 6, I noted the loop last time from the beginning of chapter 6 to the end of chapter 6. Well, here, if you go back to chapter 6, sentence 2, the end of that sentence, he said, he wishes that his anger and his suffering could be weighed on the scale. Right? Could be yis'u together. You jump to the next to last line. That was the second line in this speech. The last line, the beginning of the last line. Umelo tisa pish'i. Why can you not carry, why can you not bear my transgressions? The last one, Chafalef, Chafalef, 21. My point is simply, he uses the same word in the beginning, and at the end, it's like all, it's all of a loop. What he's saying is, Eliphaz, you want me to pray to God? Here's my prayer. God, leave me alone. That's his prayer, in one sentence. Right? That's what he's fundamentally saying. But I want to pull out two verses in particular here. Verses 17 to 19. When he says, what is man that you should elevate him? Right? This response to Eliphaz, which is even stronger as a response to Eliphaz. It's more than just the statement of, Eliphaz, you wanted me to pray, I'm going to pray. But stronger than that, Eliphaz, you said that we are nothing compared to God. Right? We are frail, God is strong, we are flawed, and God is great. Well, if we're so lowly, why is God paying attention? It's a statement about divine supervision. As a matter of fact, that line in sentence 18 where he says, you watch us in the mornings, you examine us every instant, is used in the Talmud. If you jump to the source sheet and take a look at source number 5, the Talmud has a discussion about the idea that the world is judged on Rosh Hashanah. We're familiar with the idea that on Rosh Hashanah there's a Yom Hadin, there's a day of judgment, tied into various biblical verses. And the Talmud says, well, we have other verses that indicate that we're not judged just on Rosh Hashanah, but there's judgment going on all year long. So you see here, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Adam Nidon B'chol Yom. Rabbi Yossi said a person is judged daily. Shenamar, and he quotes our verse, V'tifgedenu la b'karim. You remember him each morning. Him meaning the human being. Rabbi Nassan Omer Adam Nidon B'chol Sha'ah. Rabbi Nassan said every hour. Hour not meaning 60 minutes, but the point is every moment. Shenamar quotes the rest of our verse. Lir Ga'im Tivchanenu. That you investigate us every instant. The Rabbi Yosef Albo, in source number 6, uses this as well. Let me explain a little bit. Rabbi Yosef Albo wrote the work Sefer HaIkarim as a response to the idea of Ikarei Emunah, the idea that there are principles of faith that one must believe in order to be believing in Judaism. So he challenged the idea of having many Ikarim, and he said you can reduce the number of Ikarim, the number of principles in Judaism, to 3, basically. And he said a person who doesn't believe in them may not be a heretic, he might just be mistaken. He has a whole, it's a book, there's a lot there. But this is 14th century Italy, if I remember correctly, 14th or 15th century Italy. But he writes here regarding belief in divine supervision, and he says, V'yesh kat acheret. There is another group among the groups that he is discussing. To'in achar avodah zarah mitzad acher yoter amok. They stray after another deeper idolatry. Vezeki heim sovrim ki divrei ktsas hapilo sovrim haomrim azav Hashem es haaretz. they think, as some philosophers do, that God has left the building, that God has left the land. And they believe that this is actually part of God's greatness. That's why they say that God isn't watching. They think that part of God being so great is that he's not going to watch human beings, because human beings are lowly. And Job was inclined toward this view. Now, what he's doing here, I want to just take out of the context of what we just read and blow it up a little bit, because it's important. There are two ways I can take Eov's, for lack of a nicer word, rant, against divine judgment. One way I can look at it is the way that we've been reading it until now, which is that he's serious. He believes that God is indeed punishing him for some minor failing, and that he's angry. God, why are you doing this? That's one way to read this. And that is the way, I think it's, to call it pshat, I don't know, but I think it's a simple read. The other way you could read this, which many philosophers did, Rambam read it this way, Ralbag read it this way, Malbim read it this way, I believe Rabbi Yosef Albo was reading it this way, is that he's not serious. He doesn't think that God is actually watching at all. He believes that, as we've said on other occasions, God is outsourcing supervision of the universe, and it's all done automatically, it's astrology, it's whatever it is. But he's turning to Eliphaz and saying, within your image of God, that's ridiculous. Within your vision, because Eliphaz believes that God is in fact punishing people for doing things that are bad, so Job is saying, your vision of God doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Your vision of God posits the idea that there's a God who is great enough to create everything, but he's watching what little, you know, Eov does, and punishing Eov moment to moment for his sins. You follow? There are two different ways you can take Job's speech. One approach is, God is doing this, and I don't understand why, and I'm attacking God for it. The other approach is, Eliphaz says God is doing this, and I'm trying to show how ridiculous Eliphaz's idea is. Two different ways that you can take it. Yeah? Yeah.
Hashem did pay special attention to Eov. Hashem came, and Hashem said, go look at my servant Eov.
Absolutely.
So, maybe that's what Eov meant.
So, Eov doesn't... Right, Eov doesn't know the opening narrative. Right, he doesn't know the story.
Going to point to the way that they say that the whole thing was just written as a story.
Yeah.
Then they do.
Why?
He's writing it. Does know what they wrote.
The author does, but the character doesn't. In other words, he is presented as insulated from that first story. I would argue that if he knew about it, then it would. Well, if he really believes that God does this, then yes. What you're really saying, if I'm understanding you correctly, is if it's true that Job believes that God is doing this, and he's saying, God, why are you doing this? Then he is correct in believing it, because in fact he did get special attention. However, he's incorrect because that wasn't why he got special attention. He got special attention because along came Satan and said, right? This requires going back in time several months. But Satan said, there are no human beings who serve God properly. And God said, yes, there are. There's this fellow Eov, and he becomes subject of a test. But it doesn't prove anything about the way God normally rewards and punishes, and whether he actually watches things moment to moment or not. Because if I accept the opening story, then I accept that he's not being punished for sins at all. That's not what this is. Which is a whole other facet of this book, which is the way we interpret the things that happen to us. Right? Job, assuming he's taking this seriously, assuming that Job really thinks God is punishing him for his sins, which the story says he's not, he's misinterpreting what's happening. He thinks it's punishment, but in fact, it's this whole other philosophical debate that's going up in the heavens. So, how that fits is an interesting question. But the upshot of this is that we have these two ways to look at what he's doing. Either he's saying, God really does judge me and it's wrong, or I don't believe in this, but here's my challenge to Eliphaz for his version of it. And he does, as I've said before, and I keep stressing this because I think it's such a remarkable piece of the way Eliphaz does this. He's parodying the language of prayers to God. He's using terms of prayer, lines from Tehillim, from Psalms, or just words that we associate with prayer, and he's turning them on their head. Not necessarily out of hostility, as much as because he is broken. And everything for him, his whole way of making sense of the world is broken. And I brought you the piece in source number 7, which I referred to before, Newsom, on what he does with language. One of the frequent consequences of traumatic experience is an initial loss of language, which we saw in the first 7 days, and a more persistent estrangement from language. Both phenomena are represented in the book of Job, the loss of language in the 7 days and 7 nights of silence, and the estrangement from language in Job's speech in the dialogues. The brilliance of his speech is the brilliance of light refracted through shattered glass of many colors. Job picks his way through a shattered language that he can wield only in fragments. So he can borrow a word here and use it entirely out of context to reflect what he's feeling. Are we all together with this? Yes.
And it's fantastic you said that, except that I guess I would debate how broken his language is. Because this is one thing it's amazing that, in terms of the person to test, somebody who can come up with such phenomenal imagery and not fantastic language, of all things to say, I don't find it fragmented at all. I think it's very clear and precise that he's capable of such high-level thinking at such a traumatic time.
Right. And in the part that I skipped there, in the ellipsis before the brilliance of his speech, she acknowledges that. I skipped it only because I wanted to fit everything on one page. But she acknowledges that it's incredible speech. But at the same time, he's using words wrong. Meaning he's using words that we associate with prayer, and he's using them for if not heresy, something awfully close. He's taking what we are familiar with, the normal constructs, and turning them on their head. Not because he can't speak. He's brilliant in the way he expresses himself. But because what things mean to us, they don't mean that to him. All the things that are familiar, concepts, words, they mean something else to someone who is suffering what he's now experiencing. And he is, to move that to the next piece, I mentioned this briefly last time, he turns the narrative of hope on its head. The whole idea of hope. Eliphaz invoked hope twice. Eliphaz invoked hope twice. Once was in chapter 4, sentence 6, in which he said, your strength gives you hope. Your strength used to give you hope. And once in chapter 5, sentence 16, when he said, God provides hope for the lowly. Look what what Job does with the word tikvah, meaning hope. Chapter 6, sentence 8. He says, I wish that God would give my hope. Right? But what is his hope? He says in the next sentence, his hope is that God would crush him. Right? That's his hope. That's number one. Number two, chapter 6, sentence 19. Once again, he invokes tikvah. He says, he talks about the stream that isn't there. Halichot Shiva Kivu Lamo, the people who travel from Shiva, they hope for the stream, and the stream isn't there. Hope is something to be disappointed. It's not something to be fulfilled. And then in chapter 7, sentence 2, he has Kisachir Yikhave Pa'alo, like the laborer who hopes for the payment for his work. And once again, it's not there. And then finally, in sentence 6, he said, his days, yichlu be'efes tikvah, they end with no hope. For Eov, hope is something to be disappointed. For Eliphaz, hope is what it's all about, and things can get better. And for Eov, hope is a dead end. So, what we're seeing here overall, before I sum up his response, one other piece to see, and then we're going to try to make some sense out of all of this in summary. But take a look at source number 8, because you can't really do this without it. I mentioned before that Ralbag's school, like Rambam's school, like Malvim's school much later, is that Iyov doesn't really believe that God is running the show. He doesn't really believe what he's saying. This is all a response to Eliphaz. So take a look at how Ralbag says it. Va'o, this is his summary, Ralbag's summary at the end of Iyov's speech. He says, Va'o bi'er l'shtei sivot, she'i afshar she'yashgiach Hashem b'ishei ha'adam. Iyov offered two reasons. Two ways we know that it's not possible to say that God actually supervises human activities. Ha'achas le'yos ha'adam nim'as be'enav mitzad chisrono b'yachas al shlemut Hashem yisparach. He says, first of all, man is lowly in God's eyes. He's too flawed compared to God. There's no way that he's worthy of God's attention. Va'ashenit, and second, li'yos elu ha'yidiyos havos mischadshos tamid. V'yashar she'tihyena v'ashem yisparach yidiyos mischadshot. He says, because people keep doing new things. And as people do new things, if God is aware of them, that means God is effectively changing, because God learns something new. And God can't learn something new because God is unchanging and perfect and so on. And therefore, it must be that God does not get new knowledge of the things that we do. Now, that's a whole other philosophical discussion which he reads into Iyov's words, which we're not going to spend a lot of time on right now. It's a great philosophical question, going back to the times of the Greeks, of how can you posit the idea of a God who, on the one hand, is aware of things as they happen, but on the other hand, doesn't change. It's its own discussion. But the point that I'm bringing here is just to show you the other side of how Iyov is read. But again, I want to give a summary that will help everybody, especially people who have been sort of in and out over the last couple of weeks, to capture what's going on. Iyov turns to Eliphaz and he says, you say I must have some guilt. Well, if so, why aren't you helping me? Tell me what I've done wrong. In some way, assist me. You say that anger is foolish and self-destructive, but God has forced me to be angry by torturing me. You say I should turn to God in hope for help. I turn to God in defiance. The only help I want is for Him to end me. And you say that God helps, that God being here for me is wonderful. I say that God's presence is painful. Or if I take Ralbag's position, I say that God can't possibly be present, that it doesn't make sense for God to be present. You believe there is a narrative here, but no, there's no logic. There's no explaining why things happen, and there's certainly no advantage to waiting over time, and there is no hope. Nonetheless, he's still holding back. First of all, as Dot Mikra noted, he has not blamed God for injustice yet. That he has not said. Don't worry, it's coming. But he hasn't yet. And number two, he hasn't mentioned God by name. He hasn't, so to speak, named God as the villain. It's sort of been implied, maybe more than sort of. But he hasn't crossed that line yet. But he has a ways to go, because his friends, so to speak, are still going to push, as we'll see. Yes?
The GPS names God.
Yeah.
In the translations, you and your are always capitalized.
Yes.
So that's...
Yeah. And because he is addressing God. But he has yet to say, God is torturing me. To actually make that statement, you're right, that it's for sure the implication of it. Nonetheless, the language will be stronger and more explicit as we go along. So that's all chapter 7. Eliphaz has spoken and given his version of things, and now it's time for Bildad to give his version of why Iyov is suffering. Bildad speaks second, indicating his status is below that of Eliphaz. And I say that because when we get eventually to the fourth speaker, to Elihu, he's going to make the point of saying that he has waited because he is junior, and that's why he didn't speak first, in the sense that there's a certain seniority to the first one and then the second one and so on. Like Eliphaz, he's going to refer to received authority, right? Eliphaz talked about having some kind of prophetic vision. Bildad, being lower, is going to credit it to received wisdom from his ancestors. Eliphaz was very flowery and spoke at length. Bildad is very terse and very direct. all but one sentence is going to be made up of two clauses. X, Y, X, Y, X, Y, all the way through the chapter. One other sentence that may be read as more than two clauses, I'm not so sure. He has no flowery language. He does use metaphors, as we'll see. And he has some nice use of words for their sounds, but you don't see the flowery speech that we saw with Eliphaz. He also never has more than one chapter, right? Eliphaz gets multiple chapters. Bildad is always one chapter, and they tend to be short. They're not just different in style, though. Comparing the words of Eliphaz and Bildad, Eliphaz offers a vision of this is how you can gain divine favor, this is how you can get a good life. Bildad's words, in all three of his speeches, are focused on justifying divine actions. It's almost as though I don't really care about what happens to you, Eov, but I do care that you think positively of God. And therefore, I'm going to spend my time explaining that God is in fact just and righteous. If you take a look at the flip side of your sheet, source number 9, I brought you Rambam in his version of it, although others have others who followed said it as well. Eliphaz believes that everything is just. Everything is fair. Bildad, in his justification for God's actions, is willing to say it's not always punishment. When someone suffers, it's not always punishment for something they've done wrong. But it's still fair. Take a look. He says, Dad Bildad Hashuchi, we're in source number 9. Dad Bildad Hashuchi, Bezos Hasheila. The view of Bildad the Shuchite regarding this question of, hey, how can somebody suffer? He emunat hatzmura vehagimul is belief in exchange and reward. Tmura, substitution, exchange. And what that means is the following. Vizeshu amar li'yov. She'elu ha'korot ha'atzumot. Im atanaki ve'en l'chachet, sibatam higdil ha'gmul. V'yumar l'cha ha'tova shebatzmurot. He says, these terrible things that have happened to you, if you're truly innocent, if you haven't done anything wrong, then the cause of these is to increase your reward. You're going to receive the greatest good in exchange. Things are going to be wonderful for you in exchange for what you've suffered. V'zeh kulo tov l'cha l'rabot ha'tova asher tasig eleha v'olam haba. This is entirely good for you to increase the good you will receive in the next world. Rambam understands Bildad to be saying that you may suffer without having sinned, but you should know it's still going to be fair. Because God will pay you back later. Is that a satisfying answer? Do we like that idea? Gee, thanks. Now I feel much better.
He gets back in the end. He gets all his wife, gets his children back.
No, but they're not the same. That's not
what of course it's not.
So in other words, he's suggesting that Bildad is right.
In a terrible way, you want to read it that way. Yeah, of course I don't like Bildad that way.
Well, keep in mind what we said last time, because I want to stress this again. It isn't sufficient for us to take sides with Eov, even though that's certainly the most emotionally satisfying thing to do. Because this book survives, not only because it's a, because no one read it and therefore no one would take it out of Tanakh. No. This book survives because it has things to say that are in fact important, and each of the speakers has to have a justification. There has to be something, some kernel within each of the speakers that matters to us. And so even though I find it difficult to accept Bildad's philosophy, nonetheless, he's more than just cruel person number 2 in the cast who is going to make Eov's life miserable. What he's saying is an idea that has a degree of appeal to people, of there is justice. It may not be about something that you did wrong. It could be that there's a reward that's coming for you eventually. We find the idea Talmudically, actually, the idea of Yisurin, of suffering, that is meant to be something that will ultimately build up one's reward. Something is good, you'll get something back. Not everybody agrees, not everybody accepts it, but it's there. And that's what Bildad seems to be putting forth here. He's also stronger than Eliphaz in his harshness towards Eov. Take a look at source number 10. Actually, before we see source number 10, it might be worthwhile to just to open to one of his sentences. If you take a look at chapter 8, sentence 4, this isn't entirely fair because I'm taking his sentence out of context, but you have to, or else the comment we're about to read won't make any sense. He says, "Im banecha chat ulo, vayishalchem biyad pisham." Yeah, he drags in Job's children, right? The ones who died. And he says, if your children sinned against him, then he sent them in the hand of their sins, in the hand of their iniquities, whatever the translation is that you have. It sounds like he's saying to Job, well, there's a reason why this happened to your kids. How brutal is that? Yes, so we're going to have to see that sentence and do better with it than just pulling it out of context. There's more to be said about that sentence. I'm only mentioning it now because it's critical to reading source number 10. We have to come back to the sentence. We're not ready for it. But Rabbeinu Bachya, writing in his philosophical Kad HaKemach, where he addresses various themes within Jewish philosophy, in this case, Hashgacha, the idea of divine supervision, he writes... He's 14th century, I believe. There are two people whose names get confused a lot. There's Rabbeinu Bachaye, and also known as Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Pakuda, and then Rabbeinu Bachya the later. Rabbeinu the former lives in the 10th century into the 11th and writes a work of philosophy called Chavot HaLevavot, Duties of the Heart. This is the second one. So he writes, Bildad Hashuchi Cholek al Iyov Umsayeya Divrei Alifaz Chavero. Bildad disagrees with Job, and he assists, he supports, the words of Eliphaz, meaning that there is justice. Vayu dvarav chazakim midivrei Eliphaz. His words are stronger than the words of Eliphaz, because remember, Eliphaz was very subtle in his first speech. Eliphaz did not say at any point, you've sinned, you've done something wrong. He urges him to approach God. But Eliphaz doesn't say, you're a bad boy, Job. He hasn't done that at all. His words here, the words of Bildad, are stronger. Ki amar b'feirush, he said explicitly, ki ara'ot haba'ot aliyov v'albanav kulam b'mishpat, he says, the bad things that happen, these are all just. These are all fair. That which has happened to Eov, that which has happened to his kids. So we're going to have to see how he says that and how to understand those lines, but that's the way Kad HaKemach takes it. Fundamentally, all three of Bildad's speeches are going to be about justifying divine actions. So what he's going to say here in one sentence, what he's going to say in chapter 8 is, what looks bad will ultimately prove to be good. That's his message. In his second speech, in chapter 18, he's going to say, wicked people suffer, you'll see. Because there, the whole second round of speeches focuses on the suffering of the wicked. And then his last speech is going to be very brief in chapter 25. It's like six or seven sentences. And he just says, a human being can't condemn divine justice. But what we're going to see here is the idea that God's actions may not be a reaction to previous events. Suffering may be part of laying the groundwork for future benefits. And I gave you an outline in source number 11. I gave you an outline of how he's going to present this. The questions we need to think about as we read are, how is this chapter a response to what Job has already said? How is it different from Eliphaz's approach? Obviously, we've already introduced it and given some clues. And then, always the question in our minds when we hear Job's friends speak, how do we see him responding to this? How do we see him absorbing what Bildad is saying? So, let's take a look at the opening part, because I see we have like 5 minutes still. Good for 5 minutes still? Yeah, okay. Well, at least get started on it. He begins, as they all do, Vayan Bildad Ashuchi Vayomar. Bildad declared and said, Ad onet timalel ele, veruach kabir imrei ficha. How long are you going to say these words? How long are you going to have ruach kabir as the words of your mouth? A mighty wind. Your speech will be a mighty wind. That, I believe, is a direct response to what Job had said, because Job called their words ruach before, And so he is responding by saying, well, I call your words ruach, which I know is very mature. But the point is, you're saying that our words are empty wind. I say that your words are empty wind. Job said it in chapter 6, sentence 26. Ularuach imreino ash. And what he says in sentence number 3, then, in Pasuk Gimel, he says, Ha'el ya'aves mishpat ve'im shada ya'aves tzedek. Do you think that God is going to corrupt justice? Do you believe that Shin and Dalet Yud, this other name for God that we really haven't spent some time on yet, but do you think that God, ya'aves tzedek, that God will be corrupt? Two different ways to take this sentence. Either, when you say God should leave you alone, and what is happening to you shouldn't be happening, you are accusing God of injustice. And that's impossible. That's one way to take it. Alternatively, and this is Malbim's read, within the view that Job is actually claiming that God doesn't run the world, that it's the stars that run the world, you're saying that God is unjust for leaving it to the stars. That actually requires a little bit of unpacking. So I think I'm gonna come back to that next time rather than rush through it. That requires some explanation for the philosophy behind it. But we've begun Bildad and his approach, which is going to differ from Eliphaz's approach, in that Eliphaz believes that you have to approach God looking for hope and looking for a narrative and so on, and Bildad isn't interested in comfort. He's simply interested in saying what God does is fair in the way that he's going to try to explain. We'll pick up with that, God willing, next week.